I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. You know, as we work our way through this wonderful year, and we see all the things going on around us, you know, doesn't it make you look inward? Don't you want to think about, you know, what you believe and what you care about? You know, we're seeing this election kind of go sideways on us. We're seeing all the things that we thought were correct, maybe weren't correct. We're seeing corruption, maybe on the grandest scale we have ever seen. And nobody seems to do anything about it. That's something we're going to talk about a little bit, I think, today. But before I get into that, you know, all the political stuff that we can talk about day and night, it can sometimes drive us crazy. And I know everybody likes to talk about it, and I do too. But at the moment, I got to tell you, I'm a little bit at a loss to talk about politics because I don't know where we're going with politics. I don't know what's going to happen. We're seeing more and more people, Republican people, starting to accept the fact that Joe Biden will be the president, which seems impossible. That if you remember a year ago when people were talking about Joe Biden running for president, almost every talking head out there was saying, first of all, there's no way Joe Biden is ever even going to be the nominee, let alone be elected president. And now here we go, in a twist of fate, Joe Biden may very well be sworn in as the next president of the United States. What's that going to be like? You know, we've kind of talked about, you know, raising taxes and he's going to raise regulation. What if he takes the Senate too? See, these are the things we all have to consider it because you got to make plans. You got to plan for yourself. What am I going to do? What's my savings going to be? What's going to happen to my job? What's going to happen to my family? What's going to happen to interest rates? What's going to happen to our daily way of life? Are they going to come after our guns? Are they going to try and take your guns away from you? Is that what they're going to do? I mean, how are they going to do that? Well, I think the pandemic kind of shows us the government has a lot more power than we thought they did, right? We know they told us stay in, and people stayed in for months. That don't go out, shut your business down. How is that different from you better turn in your guns or we're going to come to your house? Didn't they go to the restaurants and businesses where people are open trying to feed their families and arrest those people? Drag them off, put them in a jail cell? At the same time, they're emptying the jails because of the COVID. They're locking people up for trying to run their businesses. You don't see that as a pretense of what could be coming down the road if they said, you better give up your guns or we're going to come and get them. Really? You're going to fight at your front door? You're going to fight at your front door when the police come to take your guns? Now, I'm not saying that the cops would do that willingly, but police officers do what they're assigned to do. And unless we had a mass mutiny of law enforcement officers saying, we're not going to take people's guns and I'll give up my job and my pension and my livelihood, police officers are going to come knock on your door and say, we have an order from a judge. It says here, according to state records, that you got three shotguns, an AR-15, and two handguns, and we're here to take everything but the shotgun. Please turn them over now. What are you going to do? I hear a lot of people, including friends of mine, say that, you know, I will stand at the door and I will make my stand right then and there. Really? You're going to have a shootout with the police? Is that what you're going to do? No, I don't think you are. I don't think you are. Then you're going to have other people going to say, oh, you know what? I'll just say my guns got stolen. You know, it's one thing to make a police report when something really happened to you. It's another to lie and make a police report, right? So I don't know where any of this is going. I don't know where any of this is going. I do know that as I consider the future, what is it going to happen, you know, to me and my family, in my business? You know, I've told you already that I teach safety and security, and I try and protect people and teach them how to protect themselves. And I teach schools and businesses and religious facilities. All of these things shut down, right? All of these things shut down. So how is I going to find another way around it? So what we did is we turned to online. We now have so many remote students from law enforcement that it's actually been amazing. We've had more students in class now remote because like they could take it from home. They could sit in their living rooms. They could sit in their personal offices. Some of them go to headquarters, but a lot of people are at home and they don't have to travel. So it's really been a change in paradigm for me, but I know not every business has that. like those restaurant people we're talking about. You know, they're talking about shutting them down again. How are people supposed to feed their family? What, do we just give the government, just keep writing us checks every minute? Think about that. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And we don't know with this election. It's not over. Is the Supreme Court going to step in and do the right thing? Well, first of all, what the heck is the right thing? All we hear is rumors. I heard that they took a machine and they put an equal number, one of those voting machines, Dominion voting machines. I heard that they put an equal number of Trump votes in and an equal number of Biden votes in. And it should have come out 100% for Trump and 100% for Biden, for whatever the number was, right? 100 votes each should have showed 100 votes for each person. But instead, the algorithm showed 87% of those votes went to Trump and 113% went to Joe Biden. That's a 26% flip of votes. Is that what happened in reality? Did the machine not count each and every vote and just tell us how many votes were for each candidate? No, now we're getting information that the machine does a tabulation and it kind of picks things out and figures out which way, you know, the voting was going. Is that what we want? I thought we counted the number of votes. 303 people voted for candidate A and 302 people voted for candidate B. Boop, candidate A wins. Isn't that what we thought happened? Or is this just a rumor? Right? Is this just a rumor? We're hearing Rudy Giuliani, who now has COVID. You know, he's out there making the case for this fight. He presented what looked like, finally, some pretty good evidence. You have people who are sworn affidavits. Do people understand what that is? When you swear an affidavit, you're swearing in front of a judge and a court that what you're saying is the truth. Now, it may turn out that it was your perception of the truth, but if it turns out you specifically lied under oath to do that affidavit, you could get in a lot of trouble. Well, not of course, if you're not an FBI agent going after the president of the United States that people don't like, then you can lie all you want. But for the rest of us, if you lie under oath, you're gonna be in big trouble. So it's really strange world we're in here. It is a strange world, and we could talk about that, and maybe we'll come back to it. But I had a topic that I really want to share with you, because it's something I'm wrestling with. This is going to be very personal. So if you got a cup of coffee, get yourself a cup of coffee. I got a little cup of coffee right here. Hang on. Very nice cup of coffee here in the afternoon. Because I'm having a little bit of a personal struggle here with something. And, you know, I appreciate everybody that, you know, reaches out to me on Twitter. It's at Pangaro Global, at Pangaro Global. And you can email me, jpangaro@americaoutloud.com. And I do appreciate all the contact and hearing from everybody. Here's my concern. In the course of my career, I worked very, very hard to do the right thing. You know, I chased down criminals. I didn't care who they were. I didn't care what color they were. I didn't care where they lived, what kind of money they had. I pursued justice for the victims that came across my desk. And there was one young man that I ended up investigating. And I'm not going to say his name, although I could. It's public record. I'm just not going to do it because it's not so much about him, it's more about me. And it's about my understanding of my place in the world and the place of compassion. So my question, before I tell you the story, is this. Is compassion for other human beings worth following no matter where it takes you? Or can compassion be used to twist you in doing the wrong things? All right, so if I ask you that question, does compassion do good stuff or can compassion lead us the wrong way? Well, I guess it really doesn't make sense unless I tell you the story now. So here it goes. There was a young kid and his girlfriend, and they were walking up the street early in the morning. I don't know, sometime in March, right? It was still cold out here in the Northeast. So the guy's wearing a nice heavy jacket. Now, the guy and his girl are probably in their late teens, early 20s. They're walking up the street when a car pulls up behind them. This guy jumps out, runs up to the guy, grabs him, and says, hey, listen, that chain you're wearing around your neck, you stole that from one of my friends, and you better give it back. Now, the guy who did this, the perpetrator, was bigger than this kid, was intimidating, And the kid didn't know what to say because it wasn't a stolen necklace. It was his necklace. It was a golden necklace the kid was wearing, you know. And the guy says, well, you better give it to me. And the kid won't give it. He tries to pull away. And with that, the perpetrator grabs the kid by the neck and pulls the chain off his neck, right? Then he says, give me your coat. And the kid had a nice coat. So he pulls the coat off the kid, jumps into the car, and he takes off. Now, the perpetrator's car was being driven by the perpetrator's girlfriend, who was well aware of what had just happened. The victim kid and his girlfriend, they got a description of the car and a partial license plate, and, they made the report. This is called, in New Jersey, this is known as a strong-arm robbery. When you steal something from someone with force, threats or force, it's considered a robbery. And a robbery is more strenuous than a theft, all right? You get bigger punishment for committing robberies than you do just taking something. All right, so this is a serious thing, a strong-arm robbery. Now, an armed robbery is when you use a weapon to intimidate someone. When you use a punch or a body or something, then it's a strong arm, it's called. So you got to understand the terminology. Strong-arm robbery, pretty serious. Here in New Jersey, you could probably get 3 years in prison if you're convicted for strong-arm robbery. So our victim reports this strong-arm robbery to the police. Patrolman takes a report, and I happen to be working that morning, me and some of my partners, and we get the information, and we're starting to follow up with it because it's a robbery early in the morning. This kid walking up a street, just a residential street. So we put this information out, and we get a call about four towns over from the police there that they have a car that matches that description with a female driver. No male in the car, just a female driver coming from the area of where our town was, where my town was. And they say, what do you want us to do? We said, well, hold on to her. We're going to swing up there because the plate kind of matches. The description of the car matches. So we got like three letters of the plate and the color of the car and all that. And it all matches. So we're fairly certain this is the car. So we drive up there. It took us about a half an hour to get there. And we start talking to this young lady. And she starts to tell us that it was her boyfriend. And I'm going to call him John. Her boyfriend, John, she was driving him to a friend's house on her way to work. And John says, hey, you see that guy? He stole a chain off a friend of mine. I'm going to get it. Pull over. So she says she pulled over. He jumped out, got the stuff, got in a car. And she says, when I asked him what happened, he said, yeah, he admitted he stole the chain. And, he said he stole the jacket too. So that's why I took the jacket. Now, this is the girl's story. Long and short of it. This is her story, right? Kind of unbelievable, but that was her story. So at this point, we're saying, okay, do we arrest her for being part of the strong-arm robbery? Can we prove that at this point? I mean, we probably have enough to arrest her, but we don't know what this kid was into. Maybe this was a drug deal that went bad. Maybe it was something else. We have to investigate more, but at least we know the girl. And now we have a suspect's name, John, right? We knew his last name. Well, over the course of time, our investigation leads us to believe that the victim and his girlfriend are very credible. And we sign criminal complaints, warrants, for the arrest of John, right? In the meantime, we have a mall, a big shopping mall. And there's a young kid, probably 19 or 20 years old, fits the same physical kind of description as the first victim. Same age, same kind of age bracket and everything as the first kid. And this kid's working in like a hot dog stand in the mall. And while he's working there, some guy, a big guy, is sitting there on the bench, kind of looking at him, staring at him, giving him eyes. And this kid's a little uncomfortable, but eventually this person walks over to him and says, hey, man, I know who you are. And the kid says, how do you know me? He goes, well, you robbed some of my friends from their drugs, and man, they're going to get you. They're going to be waiting for you, and they're going to hurt you bad. Now, this kid, this victim, was not a robber of drugs. He was just a dopey kid. But our perpetrator here was very convincing and intimidating and got this kid to believe that his friends had targeted him for an assault if he didn't give up the money. So the kid tries to convince this bad guy that he doesn't know anything about robberies. He didn't rob anybody. He doesn't know what to do. Now, the kid doesn't call anybody. He doesn't tell anybody else, doesn't call his parents, doesn't call the police, nothing. When his shift is over, this bad guy, turns out it was John, the same guy, shows back up and says, listen, these guys are going to come and get you. I know you didn't do it, though, man. You know what? I've been looking into this, and I know you didn't do it. But they think you did. So I'll give you a ride home. Now, for whatever reason, the kid says, okay, give me a ride home, and believes him. I think he was just scared to death. The kid was just scared to death. Gets in the car, and instead of going to his house, this bad guy, John, drives into the neighboring town, which is a lot more crime in the neighboring town. And he pulls over, and he stops, and a carload of guys go driving by, and he goes, you see that car, man? Those are the guys. They know you stole the drugs, and I'm telling you, I just wanted you to be serious. They're going to get you, but I'll help you. And the kid now is scared to death. He says, how are you going to help me? He says, well, you got to get me some money. You got to get me some, $500 or $1,000, and I'll pay these guys, and that'll be the end of it, and then they won't bother you. So the kid says, okay, I don't know where I can get the money, but I'll try and get you some money. He says, okay, well, where do you want to go? You got a Mac machine? Let's go to a Mac machine. So the kid goes to a Mac machine, and he takes out whatever money he could get, $300, $400, $500, and gives it to the guy. And he says to him, here, John, thanks for saving me from a beating. I'll get you another $300 tomorrow. So John takes the money and says, okay, I'll see you at the mall tomorrow. And now John leaves, goes away, drives away, leaves the kid near his house. The kid didn't want to tell him where he lived, but he dropped him off in the area. The next day, same routine. He drives him up, gets him another $300, and John says, okay, that's good, man. They're not going to beat you now. Now, while this kid's thinking about this, he's like, you know, I don't know if that was right or wrong, but hey, it was better than taking a beating. Well, about 3-4 days later, there's a knock at his door, and who's at the front door but this John kid. Now, John, like I said, was older, bigger, stronger, more intimidating. John's standing there, and he goes, how'd you know where my house is? He goes, dude, we know all about you. I'm telling you, you got to get me another $1,000, or these guys are coming. They're coming to your house now. Pretty scary stuff, right? So John says, I have no more money. I don't know what I can do. He goes, don't your parents have jewelry or anything? So the kid goes and gets a watch, an expensive watch, from his father's bedroom and gives it to this John guy and says, here, is that enough? And he goes, yeah, man, I think it's enough. I'll let you know tomorrow. With that now, John leaves, and the kid is sitting there and saying to himself, you know what? I don't know if this was really the right thing, and maybe I should tell the police about this. Now the kid came to my house, and I'm afraid he might come back and hurt my parents, hurt my family, do something to me, right? Maybe I should call the police. So he does call the police, and I get the case. Now, this is a very long story. I want you to be drawn into this so you know what's going on here. I investigate it, and when I hear the similarities in the story, I said, wait a minute. I had done a photo lineup to identify John in the first case because I got a suspect name. So I put a photo lineup together, again, including John, and I showed it to the second victim, and he picks him out immediately. And he goes, that's him, man. That's John. That's the guy right there. So now I know I got the same suspect in both cases. Intimidation, threatening these kids and taking their money, strong arm robbery and extortion, right? Well, the story gets worse from here, and I'm going to take a little break right now, but I want you to just get that basic story. You get the feeling for who John is. He's a bad guy. He's an intimidator, but he hasn't really done anything violent yet. When we come back in round two, I'll give you a little more.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health. Sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa. Award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount or call 844-869-9958.
All right, welcome back to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and we're taking you deep inside today. Now, we still didn't even get to my personal dilemma yet. I'm still just laying the groundwork for you here because we have to be introspective, right? And as we go through different periods in our life, our introspection changes to what we think is important, how we view the world, what we think about things that go on in the world. And that's all what this is all about. In my case, it's an understanding of where compassion fits into my life. And is it a good thing or a bad thing? So we left off our story recently with John the criminal, who had committed two strong arm robberies, actually a strong arm and an extortion, to young men, 19 to 20 years old, by scaring them and intimidating them and taking property from them and their false pretenses. Now, the strong arm robbery is considered a violent crime. The extortion with threats is also considered a violent crime. Okay, so that's important to understand the story as we go forward. Now, after I identified John as the same criminal in the strong arm robbery and the extortion, I signed criminal complaints against him. So now I have active warrants for John's arrest. We kind of know the town he lives in. We start surveillance on his girlfriend. We'll call her Mindy. So we start surveillance on Mindy, and we don't see her with him. We put the word out to the local PDs where we know Mindy lives and where we know John lives. And they're all keeping an eye out for John, and they're keeping an eye out to see if Mindy meets with John, that kind of thing. In the meantime, two towns over, we get a report of a drug deal that went bad, where apparently there was a guy going to be selling 3 or 4 pounds of marijuana. This is when marijuana was illegal everywhere. 3 or 4 pounds of marijuana. The buyer showed up. And like what would happen when the buyer feels in the drug world, when the buyer feels they have more power than the seller, they have advantage, physical advantage, and opportunity, sometimes they rob the drug dealer, right? Because then they figure, I don't have to pay the money and I get the drugs. Well, in this case, the seller of the drugs was in his early 20s, had the same physical profile as the other two victims I've already explained to you, only he was a pot salesman, right? He was selling this marijuana out of a hotel room. Well, the buyer shows up, and in the middle of this drug deal, it's just the buyer and the seller. The buyer pulls a gun and tells the seller that he's going to kill him if he doesn't just give him the drugs. So, of course, the seller gives the guy the drugs, and the guy takes off in a car and disappears with all the drugs and the gun. The young man, believe it or not, makes a report to the police. And he tells him, hey, I was selling marijuana to a guy and he pulled a gun on me. Because in the mind of this young man, he figured, hey, if a guy pulled a gun on me, the cops will be worried about that, not the fact that I'm dealing in narcotics. Well, the police were interested in both ends of that story, as you can imagine. Cut to the chase. They end up identifying the suspect, the guy who pulled the gun and robbed the marijuana, as, ding, 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 that's right, ladies and gentlemen, as John, the same suspect in my two crimes. So now we know we got John on a little bit of a tear here, don't we? He's doing strong arm robberies. He's actually had a gun now, or what we believe to be a gun, because some guns are not real guns, look real, and you could be intimidated by a fake looking gun. And we know that this guy he's out there now. He's running wild. So there's a lot of things could be going on. For the investigators that are out there listening to my story, your mind's already running 1,000 miles an hour going, what's he on, a drug tear? Has he got some kind of problem? All of that is irregardless to get us to where we need to be. So we know we have the same guy in three very serious crimes. When we do the background of John, we find out that when he first turned 18 years old, he had a violent crime of which he was convicted, and he did about a year in prison for it. It was some kind of he pulled a knife on somebody. I don't have the exact details anymore, but it was considered a violent crime. Again, this is important to the story as we're going forward. A couple years after that, he was involved in another strong arm kind of a robbery, all right, where he threatened somebody and took something from that person. So this he's on a tear now. He had a tear before. He actually went to jail for a year or two for each one of those things. And now he's out and about, and he's doing these things all over in the area where I'm doing my police work. So we have him identified now. We have a warrant out for his arrest. And I get a call one day. I walk into my office and my secretary is there. And she says, Joe, I got a call from this guy, John. Right? Gives me the last name. I said, Really? What did he want? He said he wants to talk to you. He heard you're looking for him. Interesting, right? How did the bad guy know I'm looking for him? So I call the number, and he answers the phone. Now, of course, my partners are trying to trace the number while I've got him on the phone, all the stuff you see on TV, and we had no luck with it. But I talked to him, and he goes, hey, listen, I'm John whatever. He goes, I hear you're looking for me. I hear you got a warrant for me for robbery. So, you know, words mean thing. If I say to the guy, a warrant for robbery? Robbery means you're going to jail, and I can't imagine he would turn himself in or cooperate. So I tell him, no, man. I said, I'm looking for you because somebody made a report that you got into an argument, and you know, you roughed this guy up, and I'm trying to get your side of the story. Now, John was not stupid. He was not a stupid man. He's like, listen, man, that's not what my guys are telling me, that it's a robbery warrant. So that led me to believe that somebody somewhere in the system knew this person and passed information on. I don't know who it was, but irrelevant for our story. But he knew I had a warrant for him. Well, I talked to this guy every day. He would leave a phone number from a different location, and I would call him, and I kept telling him, listen, just come in and see me. I'll get your side of the story, and we'll go round and round with this. And he said a couple times, okay, I'll be there in a half hour. And of course, he never showed up. One day when I come to work, I'm sitting at my desk, and the phone rings, and it's the police department next door, the Asbury Park Police Department. And they say to me, hey, we got this guy John under arrest on your warrant. You want to come and get him? So I send a patrol car over, go over, pick up John, bring him back to our police station, and I begin to interview him. We have a lengthy conversation. We cover the two different crimes I had in my town, the strong arm robbery and the extortion, for which, long and short of it, he ends up admitting to being involved in those things, but not for the reasons that the victims told me. You know, they owed him money for drugs, and, you know, they were real bad people, and he was just getting his stuff back. So he wanted to go with that. He didn't want to come off of that storyline. So we charge him. We send him off to the county jail. His bail was astronomical. The other department does their investigation with the marijuana. And again, he admits to that, but says he never had a gun, that the guy pulled a gun on him. He happened to grab the bags of weed and take off to, you know, whatever his nonsense story was. But he was involved in all three. He was charged in that crime as well. Now, the prosecutor in the case, a tremendous young attorney, really, really smart, gets this case, does all the research, prepares us for trial, and says, hey, listen, just so you know, here in New Jersey, this is going to fall under the three strikes and you're out law. Now, in New Jersey, we have a law, three strikes and you're out. If you are convicted, not charged with, but if you are convicted of three violent crimes, your sentence can be life without parole. No chance of ever getting out. You go to prison, you stay there forever. So when we add up John's crimes, he had two previous violent crimes that he was convicted of. One of them, they felt, was probably not going to hold up in the eyes of a judge, you know, 7 or 8 years later as a violent crime. But one of them definitely would. So he had one strike there. Then we're going to run a trial on my first strong-arm robbery case. We're going to run that trial, and if he's convicted of that, that'll be strike two. Then they did the marijuana case in the other town, and that would be strike three, and he would be sentenced to life without parole in prison. We managed to do those trials, and he was convicted in my case and in the other town, and he had three strikes, and you're out. The prosecutor at that point had my other case, my extortion case, which was considered a crime of violence. And the prosecutor made a decision to run that trial anyway, even though at this point he was going to be sentenced to life without parole, never getting out, ever getting out, dying in prison. And he was going to run this case anyway, this trial, in case somewhere along the line, down the road, some liberal judge decided that they didn't like the sentence, or some liberal appellate court didn't like it, that we would have another conviction, which would be four violent strikes against this guy now. He would definitely go to prison for the rest of his life. So we run that trial, and we were successful in that case also. So now John has now got four convictions, maybe five, if that fifth one would have held up. But, you know, under scrutiny, the sentencing judge may not have accepted it, because this is a serious penalty. Now, at the time, John was 26 years old. 26 or 27. 26 or 27-year-old young man. And the judges, you can assume, would be saying, putting a 26 or 27-year-old man in jail, for murder, you get 30 years. And you can get out with parole after 30 years, sometimes sooner. That would make him in his 50s. But the judges are saying, this is life without parole. No chance of parole. In prison for the rest of your life, from 26 or 27, until you die at some ripe old age, living in a prison your entire life. So the judges, that was the concern, that some judge along the way would say, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not going to bed with that on my mind. So we did the four convictions, maybe the fifth one. And off this young man goes to prison. Now, before you think you know where my story's going, let me add some more information. Because so many of us were investigating John and trying to figure out what he was all about, where he was. We start doing his background. We know his history, his younger history. We know all that. While John is in jail, he starts writing threatening letters to the victims, stating that he has people on the outside, and if they testify, if they do A, B, C, and D, those people, his friends on the outside, will hurt them, hurt their families, do something. They better not testify. So these people come forward and present these letters that John had sent. We did a search warrant on his jail cell, and guess what we found? The typewriter with the lazy L, you know, that matched the letters perfectly. There was no question it was him. And he was arrested and charged now with intimidation and all that kind of stuff. Not that it would matter, because he's going off to prison for the rest of his life, right? He's got sentenced to life without parole for the robberies that we had investigated. Now he's intimidating witnesses, scaring people, because he seems like a pretty dangerous guy, knows some dangerous people. When we're doing the search warrant, they found a address book where John, through his friends, trying to get him out of jail, had hired a private investigator. And the private investigator was tasked with finding the names, home addresses, and schools of the children of all the police officers involved in these cases, myself included. Well, I wasn't privy to that initial grab that they found in his cell. The prosecutor's office had done the search warrant. And I was called to the prosecutor's office to discuss the case. I said, oh, you know, the extortion case. I guess we're going to talk about my witnesses being, you know, threatened and this and that. And I get it there, and the prosecutor says, listen, I need you to take a deep breath and relax, because what I'm about to tell you is going to be shocking to you. And he begins to lay out everything they found in the cell, including this book. And he starts to go through the pages of the book, and he starts showing me officers I know, that I know them, I know their families, I'm friends with them, you know? And I see the names of their children and the schools that their children attend written in this book. And he gets to the next couple of pages and he stops and he says, now, I want you to understand, and I stopped him. I said, let me ask you something. Is my family's name, addresses, and schools in that book? And he looked down at the paper and he looked back at me and he says, no, your name is in here. Your wife's name is in here. But he doesn't have your kid's name in here. He stopped. This is as far as the private investigator got. He never got more information on you and about four or five other cops that he also had feelers out on. Well, let me tell you how that can make you feel. To realize that here you are trying to do a job. You're trying to protect society. You're trying to keep people safe. You're playing by the rules. You're doing the right things. Dangerous things. And then to find out that this guy is trying to find out who my family is, because he's going to threaten them. Or maybe have somebody do something to them. I never felt anything like that before. I got to tell you, there was anger. There was rage. Because this part of the story was such a strange thing, because when I had met this John and I interviewed him and I talked to him and I told you, he was 26 years old. he was a decent enough guy when you talked to him. If you didn't know that he was involved in these kind of robbery things, you would never think twice that this was a bad guy. You know, he was personable, which is a characteristic of some people sometimes who are successful criminals. He was personable. He was funny. He was a handsome young man. You know, he seemed to have everything going for him. And when you juxtapose what he was doing, criminal-wise, compared to who was sitting in front of you, it was a strange situation. The two did not seem to match up. But match up they did, and that's who this person was. And that was my feeling at that point when I saw that. I had to wrap myself around that. That was part of the job. That was part of the dangers of the job. He was in prison, though, forever. He didn't have a lot of money, so maybe he had friends, but how far are friends going to go? A friend's going to attack police officers for a guy that's convicted? I don't know what that's going to do, but long and short of it, John is in prison for the rest of his life at 26 years old. Now we're going to start fast-forwarding to my problem, my concerns, and where I am as I'm trying to deal with this. Now, I told you the story of John, what he did, and he was convicted of violent crimes, though he didn't really hurt anybody. He threatened, and he scared people. He showed up at their houses. Once convicted, he started threatening witnesses and having people, you know, he wrote threatening letters to them. He even investigated the police officers. So on face value, you would say, this is a dangerous guy that, you know what, good thing we got him. He's locked away. He'll stay locked away for the rest of forever. And that's one bad guy off the street. And that is how I felt. And I went to bed every night sleeping like a baby because I had done the right thing. I protected society from this potentially dangerous person who did all of these kind of robberies. Well, I got to tell you, that was 1998, 1999. So what are we talking there? 22 years ago. Probably 5 or 6 years ago, I was writing a column for Blue Magazine. You know, I write for Blue Magazine. It's a national police magazine. Anybody can get it. TheBlueMagazine.com. You can go take a look at it. And I needed to come up with a topic to write about. And I wasn't sure. And I said, you know what? We have a thing in police work called career enders. These are people you put in jail that will be there when you retire. Now, that could be somebody get a 10-year sentence, a 15-year sentence, a 5-year sentence if it's at the end of your career. So I started looking up some of these people in the Department of Corrections website just to see what they were up to. You know, what was going on with them? Who are they? Because you never know when a case could pop up, something happens. You know, you need to go back and answer more questions about a case, whatever. And I'm going through all these different people, and some of them were getting out relatively soon. Some had, you know, longer sentences. And then I came across a picture of John. And I got to tell you, it was stark. John went in as a very handsome, full of life, 26-year-old man. And when I saw the picture of this guy, he had been in jail about 10 years. 10 or 11 years by this point, by the time I saw his photograph, his most recent photograph, prison picture. And the life was gone out of his eyes. His hair had grayed. He looked worn out. He looked beat. He looked burned. It looked like he had suffered those 11 years in prison. And I don't mean from physical abuse in prison, which I'm sure he had to deal with, but from the stress of being in prison. And I saw that picture and I was frozen in staring at it. And when we come back, we'll talk about my dilemma.
The war on America's cities and claims of racism in the ranks of law enforcement have spirited a renewed debate on racial equality. It was Alexis de Tocqueville who reminded us Americans are so enamored of equality, they would rather be equal in slavery than unequal in freedom. To which I say, be warned of the shiny object, America. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Well, it's a fight for the soul of humanity.
Welcome back to this very introspective look here on Chasing Justice. Now, this this story, my story of John and my personal experience with this individual, this convicted criminal, this person sentenced to life without parole, and my involvement in that case. What this has done is it initially, I was very proud of the work that we did. We handled the case logically. We handled it investigatively very well. We followed all the leads, myself and my partners. We found our suspect. We identified everyone involved. We made arrests. We had tremendous luck in court because we had a good case. We testified well. Everything worked out on our end. And this dangerous person, John, was sentenced. Over the course of time, I never looked back and thought about it at all. And then after 10 or 11 years, I saw John's picture, and I saw a man who had been worn down by the system, a man who was a young man, a vibrant man, criminal. Now, no, don't get me wrong, criminal, but as a human being. And I think this is where sometimes in life we see the world differently. We see circumstances different. So there I was 10 or 11 years seeing this picture, this man, and I wrote this article called Faces from the Past. And it was all about my experience with John and my shock at seeing his picture. Now, it was just a photograph, but it's what that photograph depicted. It depicted the difficulty of a human being suffering the consequences of his actions. So let me be crystal clear that when I tell this story, I'm not taking any blame for John being where he is. John did everything he did knowingly, wantonly. John did bad things. John was deserving of consequences for his action against society and against the individual people that he committed crime against. There's no doubt about it. John was at fault, right? And I didn't really think much more about it other than being shocked, and I wrote that column. And I kind of chalked it up to, wow, that's life in prison must be really difficult, right? Must be really difficult. And then I closed that chapter and I moved on. Now, since that time, it's probably been another 7 or 8 years, I go to church on Sunday and I hear the sermons, and the sermons tell you that, hey, you should look out for the downtrodden, the needy, for the prisoners, right? We hear that all the time in church, especially in the Christian church. The prisoners. Doesn't mean get them out of prison. Doesn't mean to, excuse their behavior. It means they're suffering in prison. Exactly what I saw in that photograph is what they talk about. And what can you do? So I know a couple of people that actually do a prison ministry, right? Where they bring books in, they read to prisoners, they help teach them how to read, how to learn how to read. They have some people do counseling for them in there to try and help them understand their lives. And at the time, I got to tell you, I didn't know whether that was good or bad. It just not something I was involved with. And then a friend of mine who was doing this said, hey, why don't you join the prison ministry? I mean, you you put a lot of people in prison. Why don't you join the ministry? You're a good Catholic. Maybe you can go in and just give them some counseling or tell them about life or something. Maybe you can help the prisoners ease their suffering a little bit. And I thought about it. I don't have a hard edge to me. I don't know that I'm a bad person. I don't think I am. I try to always do good stuff. But the long and short of it was I didn't do the ministry. There was one young man I came across who got sentenced to prison for 5 years, and he had confessed everything to me. He broke down and told me that he was very sorry for what he did, and that he wished that he had God in his life, because maybe that would have helped him to go straight and not do the bad thing. And I got to say, this is another person I met that did bad things, not violent things, but he just did a lot of thievery, burglary type of things. But he was sentenced off there to five years in prison, right? Which, that's a long time. Imagine if you had to go to prison for 5 years. Well, this young man went off to jail. And after about a year, I was thinking about him, going through my case files. And I see, this case file. And I said, you know what? I was talking to Kathy about it, my wife Kathleen, and she says, you know what? He said that about, he wished he could have found God. Why don't you send him a Bible and a note? Now, This was not something, I don't send Bibles to people. You know, I go to church, but I don't send Bibles to people. But I thought about that, and I said, well, this guy specifically mentioned that he wished he would have found God. I've been on a journey to try and find God and my place in God's world since I can understand what God was. You know, I'm still on this journey. I'm still trying to figure out who I am and where do I fit into all of this, you know. So I said at the time, you know what? What's it going to hurt? So I went out and I bought a Bible. I wrapped it up, put a note on it, said, I know you were trying to find God. Maybe this will help you. And I mailed it to him. Well, the guy wrote back to me about a year later and he thanked me. He says, I read the book. I still read it every day. I think I'm a better person, but I have a long way to go. And he thanked me. And I said, wow, that was good. Aren't we supposed to do things like that? All part of the journey for me. And that's why I'm telling you, this is my introspection. And I'm throwing it out there because we all can go through these moments of introspection and trying to find out who we are and understand what all of this means to us. So that brings me back to our guy, John, now. So now all these years have gone by, and I keep hearing in the back of my head this voice. Now, I don't hear voices. I'm not talking about those kind of voices. But I'm hearing, you know, when I'm at church, you know, oh, do the right thing, and, you know, think about the poor and the people and this and the prisoners. And I keep hearing that, and somehow that's connecting to me only in a connection to John because of the fact that John was sentenced to life without parole. Never get out. And I think that is what really caught my attention. You know, you can kill someone. You can wantonly murder someone and you'll get 30 years in prison. That's a long, long time to get 30 years in prison. That takes a big hollow, that hollows out your life. And, you know, it's a very severe punishment for a very severe thing. I might even call for stronger measures than that if you kill someone knowingly and wantonly. But that being the case, 30-year prison sentence is a big prison sentence. But the thing is, people that kill people, the ultimate crime, they often get out of jail. John would never get out of jail. Now, John didn't kill anybody. John didn't actually hurt anybody. He didn't shoot anybody. He didn't stab anybody. He didn't choke anybody. He intimidated some people. He intimidated a couple of easily intimidatable young men. He basically pulled a scam on them and scared them to get money out of them. Bad, all bad stuff. Believe me, I wouldn't do it. You wouldn't do it. I wouldn't want it done to my kids or your kids. But this is basically what this guy did, even though they're crimes of violence. You know, well, strong arm robbery is a crime of violence. What are you going to do? He did a whole bunch of them. But as I got to thinking about this, I don't know. It's the weight of the fact that a murderer will get out of jail. And this guy never will get out of jail. You know, it was just in the back of my mind. And every once in a while it would come up and I would think about it. Especially when I was at church. Because, you know, doesn't the sermons at church, don't the readings at church, don't they always call you to your better angels and call you out, right? Remind you of things that you don't always want to be reminded of, right? How you're supposed to be better. Whether you go to church, synagogue, mosque, doesn't matter where you go. They're all trying to call you out and tell you to be better and recognize your sins and recognize your place in all this. So this was coming up repeatedly for me, repeatedly, repeatedly. And very recently, I had seen an article in New Jersey, and they were talking about the life without parole people in New Jersey. There's only about 40 of them in the whole state that have ever been convicted of that three strikes you're out and are doing life without the chance of ever getting parole, without ever getting out. And I think here's my dilemma. I have compassion for human beings who make mistakes. I make mistakes. I'm a sinner. Right? And while I know this John guy, when he was 26, was scary and threatening, and he did things that were bad, and he should be held accountable for them. Maybe I keep thinking, 24 years is enough for that. Maybe 30 years would be enough for what he did. But 50 years? till he dies in that cell, and that's when he gets to go out? I don't know. And this is where I start to say to myself, okay, are you just moving along in life and you're seeing the world different and you're being more compassionate? Maybe you're hearing the words in church a little closer and maybe you're thinking, I don't know. I'm trying to figure this out. All I know is I thought about John a lot recently. And the idea came to my head, I don't know, maybe I should just write to him, send him a Bible like I did with this other guy. And then it dawns on me, this is a guy that was researching cops, right? Now, I don't know if he would have done anything, if anybody would have done anything, but that was his idea in his head to do that. But that was in the head of a 26-year-old. How many years ago? Right? Is that the same guy that's in there now? Maybe he has found God. I don't know if he's deserving of anything more than rotting away in a prison cell for the rest of his life. I just know wrestling with it is the wrong words. Wrestling with it is definitely the wrong words. I'm just trying to figure out what I think is correct. So what do? I call the prosecutor who prosecuted the case, who's a friend of mine. He's now in private practice. Like I said, brilliant, brilliant attorney, smart guy. I had a lot of cases with him. I really trust this guy. And I reach out to him randomly in a text message on a Saturday night. And I said, hey, how's everything going? He says, oh, great, man. How you been? And we're talking back and forth. I said, listen, remember John? I know he was a bad guy. But do you think a guy who did what he did should spend his entire life locked up in a jail cell? And I really didn't expect to get a response. I mean, it was a Saturday night, right? Who's sitting around texting Lieutenant Joe on a Saturday night about a prison case from, you know, 20-something years ago? Well, surprisingly, he hit me back right away. And he says, yeah, I remember John. And he recited everything about the case. He goes, you know what? He had 5 indictments on a bunch of different things. And I offered him a deal that would get him out 4 years from today. He'd be done. Right? He will have done like 28 years for all his crimes. And you know what he said to me? He looked at me in open court and he said to me, F you. And instead he wanted to go to trial. And he lost. That's the deal he took. That's the chance he threw. He was offered something and he wouldn't take it. And I listened to that. And I looked at that answer and I read it. I probably read it 6 or 7 times over. And I was trying to put together the words that my friend was saying. And I was trying to understand it. And I said, okay, have you ever said anything in the heat of the moment? Have you ever said anything when you were younger that was stupid, that if you could go back and change it, you would? That if you could look at it in a different way, you probably wouldn't do it the way you did it back then? Yeah, I think we all do that. I think we all have that moment. So here's this brash young man who had no family, who had no friends, who had nobody, who had no real life opportunities. Now, I believe this is not a sob story. I'm not the, oh my God, John. John made bad, bad choices. He did bad, bad things. I've been in a bad way. I didn't have money and I didn't do things that John chose to do. So this is not a sob story. I'm just trying to understand the role and place of compassion for other human beings. Do we look at the time that's gone by? Do we care? I mean, let's juxtapose this. Somebody killed 3 people when they were 26, murdered them in a robbery, and now they're 68 years old. They found God. They do have a church ministry. They counsel other prisoners. They're all great stuff. Should they get out? Should we say, well, they really turned? Or is the fact that they took lives the determinant factor? I kind of fall down that way. You know, I used to say all the time, when the people you kill can get back up out of the grave and go back to their family and their friends and be with them again, then you can get out of prison. And I still kind of believe that. I mean, you kill somebody like that, you take them away forever. 30 years, you know, if you're 26, you get out at 56. You get out almost at my age and you can have a whole life, right? Have you paid enough for taking those lives? That I don't think so. I think you forfeit everything when you commit that kind of a crime. But that's what's making me look at John and saying, John did not commit that kind of crime. But the very same year that John was arrested and convicted and sent to prison, there are people that were in that same prison with him that did kill people, did take away family members, loved ones from people. And they get out in a couple of years. John will stay there because of his behavior until he dies, maybe another 30 years in prison. What is the role and place of compassion in our system? So I texted back my friend, the prosecutor, and I said, but do you really think he should spend the rest of his life in prison for that? And I didn't know if he was going to answer me. And he did hit me back a minute or two later. He goes, listen, I wouldn't be offended if he got out. He made his own bed, but that's a very severe sentence he called down upon himself. And I said, okay, maybe it's time to do something to make life a little bit better in the bigger scheme of things. And that's my dilemma. That's where I am today. What is the role and place of compassion? Do I do anything to start the ball rolling, to say, hey, I'm the guy that arrested this guy. Maybe he shouldn't spend 50 years in prison for this. Maybe he learned his lesson. I don't know. I'm at a crossroad. I'm trying to understand what I should do next. It's funny. I was talking to Kathleen, and we were talking about the intimacy of people and their relationships with each other. And that's really what this is. This is an intimacy with me and myself to understand who I am. Where do I stand in this? It's not a dilemma that's, you know, eating me up, but it is part of justice. That's what we say here, right? We're chasing justice on this program. What is justice in this case? I'm trying to figure it out. I don't have a stake in it other than I was there. I don't feel responsible other than the fact I did my job. John did everything that got him where he is. But if I see a light at the end of the tunnel and I have an opportunity to say or do something, should I? Should I do something? I don't know. I'm thinking about it. I reached out to a friend of mine who's a warden in the prisons in New Jersey, and I asked him to look him up, look John up, and he found him. And he said to me, hey, listen, man, I see lots of people change their lives in here. Before you make a decision, why don't you make an appointment and go sit down and talk to the guy and see if he has changed his life or not. Talk to the people where he's been living. Find out if he's a good guy in prison or if he's really not a good guy still. See what else he's done before you make your decision. And I think that's very, very good advice. Because I would be less comfortable letting John get out of prison if he did one more violent thing to anybody. I would feel that would be on me. Because if I started a ball rolling, not that I could, not that it would change anything. But if I did start a ball rolling that changed his circumstance, I don't know if that's right or wrong thing to do. I don't know if that's the moral thing to do. I don't know if I just leave it be. I spent my life in law enforcement protecting people from people like John. What if John needs now protecting from the system that has him? I don't know. My friends, this has been a venture into the heart and soul of Lieutenant Joe. I appreciate you being there and letting me vent this out, especially this time of year. I'd love to hear from you at Pangaro Global. And in the meantime, remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem.